Welcome to the RACS podcast, bringing you insights and opinion on the built environment from around the world. I am Francesca Fowler-Walsh, MRICS, Royal Chartered Surveyor at Natural England, Chair of the RACS Matrix Lancashire Committee, and an RACS Northwest Region Board Member. Today, we're joined by Caroline Sampson, Head of Sustainable Banking at Oxbury, and by Maddie Nash, MRICS and Fellow Royal Chartered Surveyor and Estate Manager for the National Trust. I'm delighted to be joined by Caroline and Maddie to talk about all things the twin challenges of climate change and biodiversity decline and the opportunities we all have to make a positive difference. So first up, I'd love to hear a little bit more about your roles and your organisations. Maddie, do you want to go first?
Thanks, Francesca. So as Francesca said, I am an estate manager with the National Trust and I cover properties in Lancashire, West Yorkshire and some in Cheshire as well. I started with the Trust when I graduated in 2016 and I joined the Trust's APC programme, qualified in 2018, and they haven't managed to get rid of me since then. My total portfolio is around 4,300 hectares. About 65% of that is moorland, with also some farmland, woodland and dune habitat. I also look after some residential rental properties and farms, and I manage the Letter Estate and support our property teams in managing the in-hand land.
Wonderful. And Caroline, could you tell us a little bit about your role? And for those who don't know anything about Oxbury, what Oxbury does and why it was sort of founded?
So let's start with the bank. Oxbury Bank was founded in 2018. It started operating in February 2021. So we've been around just over 3 years now. The bank was set up to finance the rural economy and agriculture and food production in the UK specifically. We have seen that there's a real opportunity to support farmers in the transition and therefore set up the bank to finance and provide relationship-based initiatives for farmers. We pride ourselves on the fact that the vast majority of our relationship managers are either farming themselves or come from a farming background, and that we therefore bring a real lived experience to the industry. My role as Head of Sustainable Banking incorporates anything that looks sustainability related. Some of it is internal, so looking at our internal carbon footprint and general sustainability around our own operations. But given that the biggest impact is with our customers, a large portion of my work is focused on supporting customers, understanding customers, and looking at natural capital in its wider context within our customer base.
Thank you. And you obviously mentioned, Caroline, about your clients being predominantly farmers, and they're obviously hugely important in terms of managing our natural environment. Do you rely much on rural chartered surveyors to provide support with regards to the natural environment and natural capital and in terms of banking operations?
So we use chartered surveyors extensively to confirm valuations of properties where we're looking at security. And we are at the moment looking at how we are going to bring natural capital valuations into our processes. Traditionally, it's been very much focused on the property value, the crop value, and things like that. We're at the start of assessing how specific natural capital values will feed into that process. And so what we'd like to see going forward is working with chartered surveyors on how do we develop methodologies that's reliable on valuation of different types of natural capital.
Okay, interesting. And in terms of the National Trust estate, Maddie, obviously you've got a mix of freehold land that you guys manage yourselves, but also you've got tenanted land. Are you beginning to see the influence of natural capital when you're assessing tenants or prospective tenants? And how much does that influence your thinking in terms of tenant security and their ability to continue to pay rent going forward?
It's definitely something that's becoming increasingly relevant. And, you know, when we're looking at tenants, we're looking at tenants who have a robust business plan and who can deliver not only an excellent food production business, but also can really deliver for nature as well. And there's many ways of financing that, as we're finding out.
And Caroline, do you find that your clients who are tenants are beginning to build sort of natural capital and diversification into their business plans when they're coming to you for a prospective new tenancy or when they're looking to renew?
We're seeing a lot of variation, but as the importance of nature loss is becoming apparent on farm, we see a lot of customers being more interested in how they can restore nature. And it ranges from diversification through to action plans to restore nature, improving connectivity on farm, investing in woodlands. It's a very wide range of potential actions that we're seeing from customers. And in our estimate, customers who are investing in natural capital is building future resilience. So for us, it's a sign of risk management on farm and a attitude towards future resilience.
And Maddie, you mentioned that obviously you look after the state up in the Northwest. And are you involved in projects similar to those in terms of restoring nature and building resilience across the landscape? Could you tell us a little bit about those perhaps?
Absolutely. We have several projects on the go at the moment in various stages. And those include things like moorland restoration. We have quite a few projects that are funded through the Nature for Climate Peatland Grant Scheme at the moment. And those are looking at, you know, improving the moorland habitat. And there are so many benefits from doing that. Not only are we improving the habitat for the wildlife that lives there, we're often improving access. We're putting in flagstone paths for people to walk across, which makes it, you know, less muddy. You have a nicer time out when you're walking across the moor, and you're also doing less damage to the environment at the same time. And we're also slowing the flow of water off the hill. So one project in particular is on Holcombe Moor, north of Bury in Greater Manchester, and the communities underneath the hill have historically suffered quite severely from flooding. So by keeping the water on the hill longer, we're reducing the flashiness of the floods and the speed at which the water gets down into the main rivers, and hopefully reducing the flood risk down there as well.
Is that sort of flood, I suppose, flood resilience an important aspect of looking at your clients as well in terms of future-proofing their businesses, Caroline? And I suppose, again, decreasing the risk, as you spoke of earlier.
It is. I keep saying to people, we're a bank. So our average loan term at the moment is 21 years. So it is in our interest, if we want our loan to be repaid eventually, to make sure that farmers are entering in various practices that will build their resilience over this long term. And so as we see, farmers who are taking general actions, but quite a lot of it is participation in natural flood management schemes, assessing new woodlands, improving hedgerows, improving connectivity in general, and all of those actions will build resilience, which is not only then important in the long term, but also in the short term support their ability to produce food.
And you mentioned sort of average loan term being 21 years. I suppose, is that a similar kind of time frame that you're working to in terms of tenant farmers on the estate?
In terms of, yeah, working with our tenants, you know, the National Trust has its ambition for looking after nature. And it was founded on the principle that everybody needs access to outdoor space and to nature. And that hasn't gone away. So working with our tenants is a key way that we're going to deliver this. A large part of the National Trust holding is tenanted land. So in order to deliver our ambition, we have to work with our tenants to, you know, help them and for them to help us to put in, you know, habitat restoration, tree planting and different farming practices that can deliver on that. In terms of how long those terms are, it really can vary depending on the situation of the holding and who we're working with. But ultimately, we do recognise that in order for somebody to invest in a farm, they need security to be able to do that.
Thank you. So Maddie, if it's all right, if I could have a quick chat with you about the various different surveyors in the National Trust, obviously, I think it's fair to say the National Trust is best known for its beautiful historic houses and parklands. But you obviously have you've mentioned the farmland, the upland, and then sort of coastal habitats as well. How many different types of surveyors do you guys have within your team, and how does that all interact to kind of create a sustainable estate and for the long term?
I had a conversation with one of my property teams yesterday, and I said, what do I do for you? And they said, if there's something's happening and it's outdoors and I don't know the answer, I pick up the phone and I phone my estate manager or my rural surveyor. And if it's in a building, I phone my building surveyor. And I think that demonstrates, you know, quite how important surveying is within the trust, whether it's the wider estate where we've got estate managers who are, you know, very involved in whether it's looking at, you know, like these moorland restoration projects like I've discussed, things like way leaves for utilities and easements for access and, you know, all those sorts of things that estate managers and rural surveyors will get involved in on a day-to-day basis. But the building surveyors are also really important. We have teams of building surveyors who look after our let estates and all of our, you know, residential property and commercial properties that we rent out. And we also have building surveyors who help to look after our mansion properties and our visitor attraction. And it's hugely varied. It could be putting a new roof on a Grade 2 listed mansion, or it could be building a car park and a new visitor centre for the building surveyors. So it really is, you know, quite integral to delivering the projects within the trust. We also will sort of buy an extra resource where we need it. If we need additional support from quantity surveyors, for example, we do some valuations in-house, but often we need external valuations carrying out. And of course, we're looking at surveyors for all of those pieces of work.
Yes, it really does run through everything. So as a visitor, the likelihood is that whatever I'm seeing has been provided support by a chartered surveyor of some kind, some pathway variety, whatever you want to call it. So, oh, that's really interesting. And presumably we're all signed up to the same kind of aspirations in terms of sustainability, maybe, you know, looking at how you can improve the energy efficiency of buildings. Obviously, you've mentioned some of the incredible projects that you're involved with in terms of future-proofing our land. Have you got anything you can kind of tell us a little bit about your ambitions in the built side of things at all as a trust?
Yeah, absolutely. So the trust has an ambition to be net zero, and that's something that needs to be done across every element of the organisation. You know, one department can't achieve that on its own. So when we're looking at, you know, food and beverage, buying your cream teas in the cafes, and, you know, how we're heating our historic properties, everyone needs to be doing that. So we have a lot of programs looking particularly, like I say, heating mansions. A lot of the important collections need to be maintained at a certain temperature and a certain humidity. So we're looking at more sustainable ways to do that. A lot of properties are now operating on biomass systems and heat pumps. And that sort of extends again into our let estate, where we're looking at sustainable energy where we can. It's not always appropriate, and it's something that is definitely a challenge when we have a lot of older properties that might not like to be insulated and draft proofed. Obviously, that can cause problems in itself. So there are lots of challenges there, but a lot of what we're looking at the moment is also about mitigation. So we know that the climate is changing. We know that flooding is likely to become more frequent and more severe. And we've had some really big floods on some of our properties in recent years. So we have to look at how we mitigate against those impacts, whether it's relocating visitor infrastructure away from it, redesigning drainage, and that sort of thing, to make sure that we can still look after the properties, still deliver a good visitor experience, and also still keep our staff safe when, you know, we're working in, you know, some of the hottest days that we've had on record, and we've got staff working on the beach, for example. There's a lot to think about there in terms of mitigating from these changes.
Wonderful. Some exciting opportunities and investments for you to kind of look at. In terms of presumably your clients as well, Carolyn, you're facing much of the same challenges in terms of buildings needing works done, flood resilience. And again, that you need to bring up about food production, where we get food from. So Are you seeing much demand for finance for those kinds of resilience projects, but also the greater ambition to future-proof our infrastructure on farm?
We're seeing a lot of demand for things like more energy-efficient grain stores, so new grain stores that get solar panels on them. We see quite a bit of demand for renewable energy, biomass, digesters and things like that. We also see demand for equipment where farmers are changing their practices in the arable side of the business. And then improvements in slurry management, robotics for dairy. So there is, you can definitely see from a customer perspective, there is demand and that a lot of customers are thinking about how to future-proof. We also encourage customers where we can to do baselines. So a baseline carbon footprint, a baseline soil carbon footprint, baseline biodiversity footprints, so that they know where they start from. And to see these baselines as management tools, a carbon footprint tells you in most cases where your highest emissions is will also be a cost element in the business, and therefore managing the emissions will also allow farmers to manage costs in the process. But especially as we're starting to see supply chain demands for more sustainable practices, meeting net zero requirements, these kind of baselines become really important for farmers to provide evidence on the progress that they're themselves making.
Caroline, are you seeing a lot of pressure on farmers from farm assurance and those types of organizations to reduce their carbon footprint?
It depends on the supply chain. So some of the shorter supply chains, especially dairy, some of the vegetable ones and some of the meat ones, we're definitely seeing pressure to measure and to have mitigants for emissions coming more and more to the fore. Some of the longer supply chains, so there's very little pressure in the general kind of cereal supply chain at this point. So it depends where farmers are, but we are definitely seeing movement. And what it means from a farmer perspective is that if they are supplying to multiple buyers, they're being asked to do the same carbon footprint, but just for a different 20 cows, time and time and time and again. So we, again, that's why we're encouraging farmers to baseline and trying to work within the supply chains to try and standardize how information is collected. We very much pride ourselves on the fact that we're not going to ask customers to redo things that they've already done. Hand us what you've done and we'll make that work on our side, but don't redo.
There are a lot of different ways of collecting that information at the moment, aren't there? Lots of different ways of calculating it.
And it's confusing to farmers, and it means that what we're seeing is that very often there's no proper like whole farm view. So what you have is farmers having a range of different calculators for different bits of their emissions and not necessarily having a full farm view on their emissions. And then at the other end, carbon stored is, they might have a view on carbon stored in trees, but not below soil, or they might have some once-off soil carbon survey and nothing more than that. So what we've done for customers on a pilot basis now is to start and bring these pictures together. And that's starting to show really interesting interaction between how farmers are doing things and what that could mean for their total business rather than as a silo approach.
Presumably that's key as well to understanding where they sit in terms of their finance and how much things are costing, where there's opportunities to save or more efficiently use inputs. And have you seen a shift in approach as a result of doing those assessments and realizing that actually there's alternative ways that can save money and produce the same or better results?
We're definitely seeing customers thinking about some of these elements in quite a bit more detail once they actually see where their specific hotspots are. One of my favorites is a large dairy farmer whose initial focus once he looked at his carbon footprint was just to reduce waste on feed. So they cut their feed waste by 90%. His emissions dropped, but obviously having reduced waste by that amount, it was very beneficial for their bottom line. So once farmers start seeing that kind of impact, it becomes a much more a management approach than, okay, well, we're doing the footprint for the sake of the footprint. And that's why these silo footprints is also less helpful, is because it doesn't allow the farmer to see the full picture of what could be done.
So it's really providing, I suppose, an insight into the whole operation, perhaps for the first time. Is that fair to say, that it's really giving an opportunity to drill down into all of the elements of the farm rather than looking at the different enterprises separately? And I suppose really valuing what's there in terms of the green and blue infrastructure already.
Yeah. And it's also interesting to see the kind of interaction between the various elements. One of the farmers where we've done this is a cereal farmer, and he's always kept straw on land. And so when we look at his carbon footprint, it shows the emissions of straw on land. But when you look at his soil carbon, he has stored considerable soil carbon due to his practices. So it's okay. So both sides of the picture come together. So yes, there's increased emissions, but there's also more carbon stored. So it makes sense then to look at both ends of the equation. And that, I think, gets lost in some cases.
That's really interesting. I suppose we've spoken quite a bit about the environmental and the economic side of things. Where do you see the kind of the people side of things fitting? And obviously, we've got a real drive for connecting people with nature, and the NHS are obviously doing a green social prescribing exercise at the moment in terms of realizing the mental and physical benefits of getting out and enjoying a wonderful countryside. Where do you think, but from both of your perspectives, particularly rural land sits in that bigger picture of people?
So obviously, as I said, so access to nature and to the countryside is a really important part of the National Trust's objectives. And it's because, you know, it's been identified as being so important. It really helps with well-being. And as you said, Francesca, we are losing that connection. You know, some people grow up in cities and never get the opportunity to get outside of them, to experience that fresh air and that sort of sense of peace that can come with being out on a windy hilltop, being blasted by the rain that some people enjoy. But, you know, the way people engage with nature doesn't have to be in that really wild sense. It can be as simple as bringing nature into cities, into parks and green spaces around urban developments, and enabling people to grow plants and food and see wildlife and bees and, you know, engage with it on a much more local level without putting a pair of boots on and hiking up a mountain.
I think it's a really good point. I think, well, particularly where I live, much of our farmland is on the outskirts of villages and towns. And really, it's not that far, you know, to travel from the centre of, for instance, Blackburn. You know, it's only really 20 minutes to get out into quite good countryside in terms of it's a large expanse. We've got incredible wildlife and we're very, very lucky. And then obviously a little bit further up, closer to where I live in terms of the Forest of Bowland, and we've got some of the best landscapes, well, I'm a bit biased, but the best landscapes in my opinion in the country. But realistically, it's how we get people to understand what's there, and have the, for me, it's about having the public transport to get people out, not only from a carbon perspective, I suppose, but also from a cost perspective. We've obviously seen the development of like open farm Sundays. Farmland is obviously host to a lot of our public rights of way, and is a great way of people to connect with both our food systems, but also nature as well, for free. Do you see that as an important aspect of farm diversification, and also a brilliant marketing tool for our agricultural sector?
We've just, interestingly enough, done an exercise where we've mapped our top 20 exposures by value. It's about 10,000 hectares. And in the process, we could quantify there's about 80 kilometers of public access ways across those farms. Wow. So it's obviously, it is kind of a key element of what our customers provide. It is also, we're looking at whether we could do a methodology around natural capital accounting. And in that methodology, kind of the number of users of those pathways are taken into consideration. So one of the forms that we're looking at is in the Chilterns. They get loads of walkers through there, and it does affect the public contribution from natural capital perspective. Internally, we support the Country Trust as a charity, and their purpose is to provide children from less advantaged backgrounds with exposure to food and agriculture. So they take kids out onto farm visits of members, and they bring kind of farm in a box concepts to classrooms where the children are exposed to specific types of agriculture and farming, and just bringing that closer connection to food to the children. So we think that's important as well.
Do you know, I think that's such a brilliant kind of concept, because I'm not from a farming background at all. And I happened across rural surveying and young farmers, and it all kind of connected at a really good time for me. And it unlocked the rural economy in terms of an option to work and a career, really. So I think the more, from a selfish perspective, the more we can kind of expose young people to the joys of agriculture and food production and our rural economies, the better chance we have of really benefiting, I suppose, from the best in the country. We've got some incredible people already in the industry, and I think it would be, you know, brilliant to get more and more people from diverse background into the sector, because it can only be a good thing. And I would love to see more young people from non-farming and non-rural backgrounds getting into rural surveying, because I think it's so much more than I suppose what people perceive it to be, which is sort of quite small. But I get involved with a huge amount. Maddie's mentioned what she gets involved with, and there's so many opportunities there. So I'm really delighted to hear that's going on in terms of exposing people to the amazing industry that we're lucky enough to work in.
I mean, I'm similar. I haven't grown up on a farm, and I've spent the past 25 years in agricultural finance in various capacities. And there's such a range of things that one can do. I think what is really underestimated is just the scope of opportunity within the rural economy for people to get involved in. And I always say agriculture is real. If something breaks, it's going to have a real impact. If you drop something, it's going to hurt your toe. It's not esoteric, and it is deeply connecting to what we are and where we come from. And there's very few careers that allows you to really engage with the natural world in the way that the sector allows you to.
Yeah, and it's both from a climate and biodiversity perspective. It's not theoretical at all, because we're seeing the impacts, we're feeling them. I mean, this spring alone, you know, friends have struggled to get the lambs out. You know, logistically, there's nowhere for them to go because the ground's too wet. At the same time, we're also getting ready for potentially a drought later this year, which is kind of mind-boggling in a way that we can both be suffering from too much and too little water within the space of a couple of months. But we really do get to see and feel both the good side and the bad side, I suppose, because at the same time as I'm watching a butterfly outside, I'm also wondering, are we going to have enough water this year? So I suppose it's a really good point, as it is very tangible, and you don't get to just talk about climate change and biodiversity loss. You get to make a difference, and then you get to see the change. So very exciting.
If I can add to that, we as an organization, because natural capital is so central to everything that we do, if you're in the financial world, you're expected to disclose on your climate risk and your nature risk. And for many organizations, it's very theoretical, but for us, it's like, it is what we do. It is our customers' daily life. And so we agreed last year that every employee in the organization gets trained on natural capital risk. We use the curriculum that was approved by the Carbon Literacy Standard. And it, when I say every employee, it is our relationship managers, credit, IT, marketing, finance, everybody has spent a day getting training on both how it affects us as a bank and how it affects our customers and how we support our customers. But it means that absolutely everybody in the organization has a standard language around how we talk about climate and can really see the impact thereof in their real daily work. And that's been, I think, really important for us to bring home to every single employee as to how this is real for us.
I think that's really interesting because obviously Mark Carney kind of made the commitment or the ambition, at least to the financial sector, to make sure that every decision considers climate change. Would you like to see the same, I suppose, from the chartered surveyors that you're gaining your information from? Obviously, we do cover sustainability as part of the mandatory competencies for APC, but would you really like to see climate change and biodiversity right at the fore of the advice that you're being given?
Very much so. When we assess any loan application, there is, again, on our side, a mandatory section that deals with climate risk, biodiversity risk, general social and governance risk. And if we've had information from a chartered surveyor that says this is particularly pertinent to this site, either for better or for worse, that just helps my relationship manager to communicate and our credit underwriters to consider that accurately. And if it's good, we recognize that that becomes a lower risk loan. We can price for that. If there's a specific potential future risk, we can flag it now and work with the customer to put in mitigants over time if we know it upfront. So yes.
That's really interesting. Maddie, I don't know if you've got anything to kind of add. National Trust was probably a key factor in my childhood. We spent many a day walking around houses and parklands and going out exploring in woodlands and climbing frames and eating ice creams. It was all great fun. But actually, I think it taught me, and I've done the same with my younger cousins, the importance of looking after our environment and valuing it and seeing it as an integral part of lifestyle, really. But I don't know if you want to have a couple of comments.
Absolutely. And I think we need young people, both in terms of the next generation that are coming through now, you know, children, but also young adults who are the ones who are going to be making decisions, influencing policy, voting in elections. We need them to really understand the issues because people won't care for things if they don't understand what the problem is. And if you're not somebody who experiences nature, who experiences the impacts of climate change on a daily basis, as Caroline was saying, you know, their clients are people who are facing into a lot of these climate issues that we're seeing. We talked about, you know, increase in flooding and things like that. If you're not experiencing that yourself at this point, then perhaps you don't understand the importance of protecting the environment, reversing the biodiversity crisis. So people really need to understand the impact that it has on them, that it has on the wider economy, in order to take action to protect these things and improve them and reverse these crises that we're seeing.
That's one of the real opportunities that the RACS and you know, members such as ourselves have to deliver that knowledge, or I suppose knowledge and learning opportunity. That obviously we've got various schools challenges that the RICS have done, but I think it's really interesting that as surveyors particularly, we're right at the kind of centre of both the built and natural environment. We get to be part of a project right the way through from its sort of first inception, really, right the way through to a you know, building or a project coming to the end of its life and moving on. So I suppose we've got that opportunity to engage young people by going in and talking to them. And there's a real connection, I think, between what our built environment and our buildings look like and how they behave, and whether, you know, we've got the likes of simple things like green roofs, and then how that then connects with our food and where it comes from. Because I don't think there's necessarily that conversation going on between, you know, the likes of pollinators and making sure that they have connectivity corridors through urban spaces so they can go out and pollinate our crops, and then what ends up being, you know, toast on a morning. You know, that whole life cycle between our built environment and our natural environment and where it all sits together and how it contributes to our day-to-day living, I think is a conversation that I think we all ought to have more frequently, and I can definitely get excited about it.
I think so. And I think surveyors as a profession could have so much impact on the natural environment. Everything, you know, surveyors are advisors, and we advise our clients, and we're doers, we manage projects and, you know, implement things. And whether it's managing waste through a program, through a project, whether it's looking at more sustainable building materials, advising a land manager on, you know, connecting habitats, there's a real difference that surveyors can make through advising our clients on sustainable practices.
I do think it all kind of, it sits within the same thing, because for me, I know I've mentioned this to Caroline before, I hate the phrase getting to net zero. I hate it because it implies that we're going to be in a static state of all things are great. But for me, it very much is a journey that we will continue to walk on, you know, forever, really. So it really bugs me, and I really want to get children excited and all generations, I suppose, because we're all part of our communities, and communities have to deliver for themselves, and collectively we can have a massive difference. But
it definitely goes beyond net zero. You know, we need to, it's not just about not having a carbon impact, it's about a circular economy or a regenerative economy where things are put back in, and we're, you know, what we currently see as waste maybe isn't seen as waste. Caroline mentioned earlier that farmers are looking at anaerobic digesters, for example. And I know there are systems out there where they're using what would originally be waste from cow sheds, slurry and manure, and, you know, splitting that out into a liquid and a solid. Solid can be reused as bedding, and the liquid can go through an anaerobic digester to power the milking parlour, for example. So I think really looking at everything, every element of food production, buildings, and identifying, you know, where savings can be made in terms of carbon and waste, and where there are things that we're currently seeing as waste that actually could be really useful.
Yeah, I suppose it's going back to the olden days, isn't it, really, where we go back to looking after what we've got and valuing everything that we produce. I'm not suggesting I went to get pigs in the garden, because I think I might be in big trouble. But, you know, there's all opportunities, aren't there?
Well, one of my colleagues is looking at being much more circular on farm, and looking at some of the, how do you cover waste and things? And he's going, well, 50 years ago, my grandfather used the bags in which things were delivered, and they were from Hessian. Now everything is plastic. Okay, so hang on. I need to now go and rediscover what material I can use to cover waste and things that we want to turn into compost and things like that. So it's really interesting around rediscovering some of these ways in which things were done. I think surveyors specifically, because by their nature, they, as you said, Francesca, is that because they both plan and they do, being able to translate and talk into a language that people understand quite practically. So taking these kind of concepts of net zero or carbon efficient, and just taking those concepts and making it really implementable and real, is quite an important role for surveyors to play, because we can get very technical and into all kinds of terminology, but turning it into a language that is easy to understand, that you can see the benefit, the opportunity is clear, or on the other side, talking about a future risk and how we mitigate that properly, but in a very clear and straightforward language, is quite important, we find. And I think surveyors are ideally placed to be able to do that translation quite often.
Yeah, I think it's really helpful that you both have managed to bring us back to that starting conversation about what is it that surveyors do already. I suppose my question for you both now is what do you want chartered surveyors to do for your business going forward? And what would you like to see the RACS develop to try and support your businesses and the trust, Maddie, in terms of moving forward and our transition to kind of a low carbon economy and a more nature rich society, I suppose.
So what we know is that we need to be able to provide a wider picture of the value of an enterprise. And so not only the economic value, but also look at the contribution of natural capital in its various elements. Where we are at the moment is seeing a lot of testing of concepts, a lot of ideas, methodologies being discussed. Ideally, over time, what we would like to get to is that there's consistency in how these valuations occur and that we can start placing our confidence in when we receive information from surveyors that we can reliably use it in how we assess that specific property, and that we can see what the wider contribution of nature is to an enterprise. It's fairly easy, I think, to bring in elements like where we've got ecotourism, where glamping pots and things like that. And timber values is fairly easy to bring in. But it's the more challenging ones like how to assess pollination and pollinators availability and things like that, where I think there's still a lot of work to do. And then to get to a point where we can agree what's good enough, there's perfection and there's good enough. And sometimes good enough is good enough.
I think that's a really good point about good enough, because I was doing a bit of reading around the Task Force for Nature-related financial disclosures and this acknowledgement that we don't have the data or all the data we need right now, but that should not stop us from starting to look at this and starting to assess and disclose and come up with an action plan, because we can all adapt later. There's not much else in what we do that is all absolutely certain. We all adapt on a daily basis. So I suppose nature is just the same, and the data around nature is exactly the same. So I think it's really reassuring that from the bank's perspective, that just, you know, good enough is fine. You know, we're never going to be perfect, but we can keep improving. And there's a buy-in for that, I suppose.
I would absolutely sort of reiterate, I suppose, what Caroline has said. And I think there's a real urgency with some of this work to, you know, the climate crisis isn't on hold whilst we work it out and whilst we get to perfect. And actually, sometimes we can strive for perfection, but that stops us from doing anything at all. And nature and the climate hasn't got time for us to work it out. It just needs us to start doing things. And so we can work on what perfect looks like. We can get to that point. But right now, we just need to be doing what we can.
We disclose in terms of both the Task Force for Climate-Related Financial Disclosures and Nature-Related Financial Disclosures, and it is my joy to have to write those disclosures. And what I'm finding is that at some levels, climate is easier because it's old science. There's established methodologies. Everybody does it roughly the same way. You normally struggle because you don't necessarily have the data, but the methodology is there and it's clear. Nature is a very different challenge. The methodology isn't established. And as Maddie said, you can get very tied up in individual data points around specific species or specific elements of nature. And that makes it quite challenging to then start reporting on. So it's very different in their challenges. And part of it is just to say sometimes, and as we're saying in our report on some elements, we don't know. It's the best I can tell you at this point is we don't know. We will try and get there, but at this point, we don't know.
I think there's also been a lot of funding for projects that will plant trees and restore moorland and deliver really great projects for nature. But there hasn't necessarily been the same funding for research and monitoring into the impacts of those things. And we are starting to see it come through in the Nature for Climate Peatland Restoration Grant. There is an element of monitoring that has to take place, which is fantastic. But on previous schemes, that hasn't been there. So we've been doing what we think is really good work, and we haven't yet got the evidence to say that it's doing what we think it's doing. We're only now starting to be able to start that monitoring and research. So whilst we're in that space, we need to be doing something. We need to be assessing the risks, and you know, We can't be doing things on the basis of no evidence, of course. We don't want to be doing anything that's damaging, but we do need to make sure that going forwards, when we're doing, when we're putting these projects in and we're potentially using quite innovative techniques, we need to make sure that there's proper monitoring and research going in alongside it so that we can demonstrate what's being delivered.
I think what Maddie is saying there is really important, and there's probably a role for surveyors in there as well. I also wear a hat where I buy carbon offsets, so I'm also a buyer in the market, and there's kind of importance around the quality of what you are buying, because there's so many risks that come to the fore afterwards. So the monitoring, the reporting, the evidence on the quality of what is available, and I think surveyors can have quite an important role in that, is important to provide confidence in nature and nature restoration, because it's very easy to get caught up in the headlines again there, which tends towards the negative, and being able to be sure of the quality of what is being delivered is important to create trust in the markets.
I suppose that's really important, both of those kind of elements of confidence around the data, but also about around the markets is really important for everybody else, because obviously we've spoken a lot about our work kind of on the ground, quite literally in some of the cases, but it all kind of feeds into supply chains, and there's a huge amount of kind of money being exchanged hands and kind of targets and assessments being made by other organizations, and whether they be other financial institutions or producers and other businesses that are all relying on this kind of having confidence in this data that what we're doing on the ground is actually happening, and it's happening in a way that's good. So I suppose there's that bigger picture as well of all these other kind of sectors that are looking to us to deliver data and to deliver practical benefits as well.
Yes, and I think that is underestimated for its value at the moment. But it is the headlines when it goes wrong creates a real risk to companies who has invested, who can suddenly find themselves exposed and be told that projects that they've assumed was good quality, it suddenly turns out to have flaws associated with it. And that just then makes it really difficult for other projects to come on stream, even though they're better. And it makes it difficult for other potential buyers of those kind of natural assets to have confidence.
That's such an interesting conversation, and one that I could quite happily continue for the rest of the afternoon. But I suppose what I'd really like from the two of you, if that's okay, is just, I suppose, a quick thought on what you think has gone so well thus far in terms of what we're doing for both the climate and nature in your respective field.
I would say that the awareness of climate and nature has never been greater, and that can only be a good thing. You know, the more people who are engaged, the more people who are aware of these issues, the more likely we are to make a change. And we know that we need to make a change, and we need to do it now. And the only way we're going to do that is by having a lot of people on board.
I'll absolutely support Maddie there. It is a conversation topic now that is considered mainstream, and everybody talks about it. And I think that is really, really important in building the momentum and the agreement that action is needed and how that could happen.
That's wonderful. Thank you both so, so much for joining us. And thank you for listening to the RICS podcast. How should we develop this conversation further? If you'd like to let us know your thoughts via social media or directly via the form on the RICS.org podcast page, review us on your podcast app, and check out on our page to stay up to date with all the latest episodes from the RICS.